Welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside room today, the speaker is Sarah Forth, and she will be speaking on Responses to Evil in Toni Morrison. So let's listen to Sarah.
This is a very challenging text in a number of ways. One is that I think she's doing a number of different things and braiding together a number of different strands, and she does it brilliantly. One is that on one level, this is a great psychological novel because of the way she's able to depict the personal consequences of slavery. Secondly, it's a ghost story. She's telling the story about this mysterious woman, Beloved, who gets called Beloved, who suddenly appears and affects a family tremendously. And thirdly, it's a social history of slavery told in a way that I've never heard it told before, because it's given a very personal face. The story is this. It mostly takes place outside of Cincinnati in 1872. There are also flashbacks to 1856, to Kentucky, to a place called Sweet Home, which was sort of, if there was going to be slavery, this would be a model slave-owning plantation. Rather small, and a place where the owners trusted the men, at least even enough to allow them to have guns to hunt with, and they had a lot of freedom and autonomy. But still, it was slavery. And what we see in 1872 are the consequences of slavery. It's a story in which about several main characters. I've written three on the board. I'll be talking about those three in particular, because as I was trying to imagine how I was going to talk about this very complex story, which moves forward and then backward and is woven together with a lot of mystery and suspense, I decided I have to tell you the narrative line just straight out. But through the person of several of these three characters, maybe we could get deeper into what Morrison is trying to say. Jack, have you read this book, or
no,
are you familiar with Toni Morrison's
I'm
work?
I'm familiar with her work and her style.
Okay, good.
And that's part of what drew me, is because her style is so, kind of say, reaching into the other. I mean, it really is a totally different frame of reference. And so.
Okay, good. When the book opens, we're introduced to the setting outside of a house at 124 Bluestone Road on the outskirts of Cincinnati, inhabited now by Sepha, the mother, and her daughter, Denver, and the ghost of a baby. The story behind the ghost, which is just the first of the ghosts that we meet in this book, is that Sepha escaped. Sepha was a slave at Sweet Home in the 1850s. She married Holly, who was another slave on the plantation. Holly's mother, Baby Suggs, also worked on the plantation, and Holly bought his mother's freedom. So his mother had moved from Kentucky to the free soil of Ohio and was living outside of Cincinnati. Unfortunately, the very kind masters at Sweet Home died or became incapacitated. Relatives took over the plantation and were much harsher. So what Morrison gives us is this counterbalanced picture of good slavery and bad slavery, but both are slavery and both help destroy these people. When the bad master comes and starts cracking down on the slaves that live there, they decide to leave. A number of things happen, some people are killed, but Sepha escapes with her children. She's carrying one child. She's already sent three of her children ahead with the Underground Railroad, and she expects to leave with her husband, Holly. Things happen very fast. She doesn't know where Holly is. She's able to get out, and she gives birth to this child literally on the banks of the Ohio River, and then carries the child into freedom. And they're all reunited in Cincinnati with the mother-in-law. That's in 1856. SEPA is in Cincinnati free for only 28 days before the slave, the bounty hunters show up trying to reclaim her on behalf of her master. SEPA's response to this is to kill the youngest child and injure two of the others. She managed the baby, the smallest infant, is saved, but her crawling already baby, as it's called, is she kills it so that it won't have to go back into slavery. Now, we jump ahead to 1872, and this baby has been haunting the house ever since it was killed. Setha wasn't prosecuted for this crime. I think everyone thought she was crazy, so they just sent her back. And they've been living as outcasts in the black community ever since then. Then, rather out of the blue, one of the former slaves from Sweet Home arrives. His name's Paul D. There are a number of Pauls at Sweet Home, Paul F and Paul D and Paul A. He's Paul D. He shows up and starts to insinuate himself into Setha's life and the life of the house. He chases out the ghost and really begins to open Setha up to the possibility of love again. And just as that's happening, this mysterious figure, whom they call Beloved, shows up. She's about the same age that the baby Setha killed would be had the child lived. And over time, both Setha's living daughter and Setha herself come to believe that she's the reincarnation of this dead child. Now, not to spoil your fun or anything, but there are alternative possibilities for who this mysterious child is. It's suggested that it might have been a child that had been taken and held captive and used or abused by a white man who lives down the road who ended up dead, and the child and the person was gone, and they never discovered what happened to it. So it might be a wild child. But it's never clear, and you're left to your own devices to figure out which it is. Over time, Beloved's power is so strong in the household that Paul D., who has come to live there, is moved out the door and down the street. I mean, her psychic power is so strong that, and she wants out of the way anyone who might get in the way of her relationship with Setha. So Paul D's out of the picture, and this household collapses in on itself of Setha and Beloved and her other daughter, Denver. Eventually, Denver realizes that the family is just going to disintegrate unless she goes out and asks for help, and she goes to her black neighbors and asks for help. And they come en masse in community to perform really an exorcism on the household. And during that time, Beloved just disappears, goes running down the road, and we don't know what happens to her. Just sort of vanishes. And the end of the book is Paul D. coming back to Setha, trying to get her to recognize that she can have a future. So there are a number of issues that run through the book. One has to do very clearly with slavery and the kinds of consequences that the ways it leaves people incapable of forming relationship. Another one of the issues that crops up is the question of Setha's sacrifice of her children in order to keep them from going into slavery and the ethical issues that raises. Those are the two that I most wanted to focus on. And I wanted to do that by exploring some of these characters a little bit more. In the past sessions, I've had mimeographed sheets, and we've been able to read aloud to each other. In this one, today, I think I'll just read to you. So prepare yourself for some storytelling. The first person I want to explore is Setha. And the section I'm going to read to you tells us a little bit about the institution of slavery and the way it prevented children from knowing what mothering is. This was Setha's experience growing up in slavery on the plantation. One of the children is asking about Setha's mother, and this is what Setha knows about her. I didn't see her but a few times out in the fields, and once when she was working indigo. By the time I woke up in the morning, she was in line. If the moon was bright, they worked by its light. Sunday, she slept like a stick. She must have nursed me 2 or 3 weeks. That's the way the others did. Then she went back in rice, and I sucked from another woman whose job it was. She never fixed my hair nor nothing. She didn't even sleep in the same cabin most nights, I remember. Too far from the lineup, I guess. One thing she did do, she picked me up and carried me behind the smokehouse. Back there, she opened up her dress front and lifted her breast and pointed under it. Right on her rib was a circle, and a cross burned right in the skin. She said, "This is your man, this," and she pointed. "I am the only one got this mark now, the rest dead. If something happens to me and you can't tell me by my face, you can know me by this mark." It scared me so. All I could think of was how important this was and how I needed to have something important to say back. But I couldn't think of anything, so I just said what I thought. "Yes, ma'am," I said, "but how will you know me? How will you know me? Mark me too. Mark the mark on me too." And then she goes on to, when the child says, "Well, what happened to your mother? Do you know?" Setha responds, "Hung. By the time they cut her down, nobody could tell whether she had a circle and a cross or not, least of all me, and I did look." As she's telling this story, she's remembering something else about her childhood that she had suppressed, and that was that the woman who took care of her, a woman named Nan, told her something else about her mother. It was Nan who took her hand and yanked her away from the pile of bodies before she could make out the mark. Nan was the one she knew best, who was around all day, who nursed babies, cooked, had one good arm and half of another, and who used different words. Words Setha understood then, but could neither recall nor repeat now. She believed that must be why she remembered so little before Sweet Home, except singing and dancing and how crowded it was. What Nan told her she had forgotten, along with the language she told it in. The same language her ma'am spoke and which would never come back. But the message that was and had been there all along. This is Nan speaking. "I am telling you, small girl Setha." She told Setha that her mother and Nan were together from the sea. Both were taken up many times by the crew. She threw them all away but you. The one from the crew she threw away on the island. The others from Morwhite she also threw away. Without names, she threw them. You, she gave the name of the black man. She put her arms around him. The others, she did not put her arms around. Never, never. I am telling you, small girl Seth. So that was what Setha knew about mothering. She remembered, although consciously only later, that her own mother had children after being forced into having sex with white slave traders and had destroyed the children rather than let them live. And that Setha, who had been the result of the union with the black man, she kept. About the language in the mark, I'm assuming that the mark was some kind of tribal mark. She said, "I'm the only one left now that has that." And the language was probably an African language that they continued to speak. Now, of course, all of that culture Seth lost, the language, whatever culture they brought from Africa, and of course, all of her family. Welcome. What we see as the novel progresses is that that kind of lack of mothering doesn't mean that Setha is left without really knowing how to mother her own children. And the result, but she does what she can. And the result is that when the bounty hunters show up, the only thing she knows, the way she knows how to protect her children is to make sure that they'll never be born in slavery again, or that they'll never be in slavery. Now, Toni Morrison didn't make that up. There's a story, and it comes out of Cincinnati, about a Margaret Garner. Apparently, it was in 1856, a very cold winter, when the Ohio River froze over, a group of 17 slaves crossed over on the river into Cincinnati from Kentucky, seeking to go north on the Underground Railroad. A group of them made it to safety, but another group lost their way and ended up holed up at a house. They had attracted suspicion, so the authorities came after them. One of the slaves was armed and shot at the slave master who had come after to retrieve them. And when the slave master had broken into the house, they discovered that the slave named Margaret Garner had, in fact, killed one of her children, injured two others, and was in the process of killing her infant. This was quite the cause celebre in Cincinnati for a number of weeks. Of course, the abolitionists took up the cause and tried to have her freed. There were hearings. Margaret Garner and her family claimed that, in fact, they were freed slaves, having been brought to free territory and then returned to Kentucky. But that's sort of the fine points of slave law. What ended up happening is that her master refused to sell her, even though the abolitionists raised money to try to buy her into freedom. And she disappeared back into the slave system in Kentucky, and apparently was never brought to trial. That she was more valuable as property to the slave owner than she would have been to the state to try to pursue murder charges against her. There was the rumor that on the trip back, she jumped into the Ohio River and drowned her child, her infant anyway, but that was never substantiated. So that's the core of the story that Toni Morrison used. And Toni Morrison isn't the first writer to do that. If you've read Uncle Tom's Cabin, you may remember, is it Eliza who escapes across the ice floes, the river? Well, there was another slave that was not so fortunate and who is depicted as jumping into the river and drowning herself and her infant child. So that's something about Setha. Now, Setha's mother-in-law, Baby Suggs, who was bought into freedom by her son, Holly, is called Baby Suggs Holy. And I'll explain how that came to be and what her response to the evil of slavery and her freedom was. What she discovered, this is what she discovered when she was brought into freedom. She was being taken across the river by her former owner. And the story is told that when it looked like it meant more to her son that she go free than anything in the world, she let herself be taken across the river. Of the two hard things, standing on her feet till she dropped, or leaving her last and probably only living child, she chose the hard thing that made him happy and never put to him the question she put to herself. What for? What does a 60-odd-year-old slave woman who walks like a three-legged dog need freedom for? And when she stepped foot on free ground, she could not believe that her son knew what she didn't, that Holly, who had never drawn one free breath, knew that there was nothing like it in the world. It scared her. Something's the matter. What's the matter? What's the matter, she asked herself. She didn't know what she looked like and was not curious. But suddenly she saw her hands and thought with a clarity as simple as it was dazzling. These hands belong to me. These my hands. Next, she felt a knocking in her chest and discovered something else new, her own heartbeat. Had it been there all along, this pounding thing? She felt like a fool and began to laugh out loud. Well, once she discovers her heart, she decides that that's what she's going to do with the rest of her life, is let her heart beat and beat on behalf of her people. This is what happens. Baby Suggs Holy loved, cautioned, fed, chastised, and soothed. At 1:24, where not one pot, but two pots simmered on the stove, where the lamp burned all night long, strangers rested there while children tried on their shoes. Messages were left there, for whoever needed them was sure to stop in one day soon. Talk was low and to the point, for Baby Suggs Holy didn't approve of extra. Everything depends on knowing how much, she said. Good is knowing when to stop. It was in front of that 1:24 that Seth climbed off a wagon, her newborn tied to her chest, and felt for the first time the wide arms of her mother-in-law, who had made it to Cincinnati, who decided that because slave life had busted her legs, back, head, eyes, hands, kidneys, womb, and tongue, she had nothing left to make a living with but her heart, which she put to work at once, accepting no title of honor before her name, but allowing a small caress after it. She became an unchurched preacher, one who visited pulpits and opened her great heart to those who could use it. In winter and fall, she carried it to AMEs and Baptists, holiness and sanctifieds, the Church of the Redeemer and the Redeemed. Uncalled, unrobed, unanointed, she let her great heart beat in their presence. When warm weather came, Baby Suggs Holy, followed by every black man, woman, and child who could make it through, took her great heart to the clearing, a wide, open place cut deep in the woods, nobody knew what for, at the end of the path known only to deer and whoever cleared the land in the first place. And this is what Baby Suggs preached to people. She did not tell them to clean up their lives or to go and sin no more. She did not tell them they were the blessed of the earth, its inheriting meek, or its glory bound pure. She told them that the only grace they could have was the grace they could imagine, that if they could not see it, they could not have it. Here, she said, in this here place, we flesh. Flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet and grass. Love it. Love it hard. Yonder, they do not love your flesh, they despise it. They don't love your eyes, they just as soon pick them out. No more do they love the skin on your back, yonder they flay it. And oh my people, they do not love your hands. They only use, tie, bind, chop off, and leave empty. Love your hands, love them. Raise them up and kiss them. Touch them with others. Touch others with them, pat them together, stroke them on your face, because they don't love that either. You got to love it. You. So Baby Suggs, once she obtains freedom, discovers that she has a heart, and she lets it beat for others. Unfortunately, when the sanctity of her yard at 1:24 Bluestone Road is violated by the slave traders, bounty hunters, she feels defeated, and she can't preach anymore. And soon she takes to her bed, saying, the white folks just took it out of me. They just don't know when to stop. Or she said, good is knowing when is enough. She said, white folks, they just don't know when it's enough. And she dies thinking that all that she preached were lies, and that she'd been lying to people, and that there was no way around it. So we have Seth, who killed her children, and Baby Suggs Holy, who dies thinking that there's no truth to be found to this love that she wants to preach. There is a figure of redemption in this book, however, and it's a small gleam, but it's worth making your way through this book. And that's in the character of Paul D., who comes along after years of wandering, after his escape from slavery. What I want to read about first, though, in regard to Paul D., is what his life became after he went from Sweet Home. He was sold to someone else who sold him to a chain gang. in Alfred, Georgia. They lived in cages that were dug into the dirt, sort of enclosed by bars on three sides, with a hinged barred lid, and that backed into a ditch of mud. And 46 of them lived like that, individually in 5x5 cells, 46 of them in this chain gang. And this is how he remembers his life there. All 46 men woke to rifle shot, all 46. Three white men walked along the trench, unlocking the doors one by one. No one stepped through. When the last lock was open, the three returned and lifted the bars, one by one. And one by one, the black men emerged, promptly and without the poke of a rifle butt if they had been there more than a day, promptly with the butt if, like Paul D., they had just arrived. When all 46 were standing in a line in the trench, another rifle shot signaled the climb out and up to the ground above, where 1,000 feet of the best hand-forged chain in Georgia stretched. Each man bent and waited. The first man picked up the end and threaded it through the loop on his iron leg, on his leg iron. He stood up then and, shuffling a little, brought the chain tip to the next prisoner, who did likewise. As the chain was passed on and each man stood in the other's place, the line of men turned round, facing the boxes they'd come out of. Not one spoke to the other, at least not with words. The eyes had to tell what there was to tell. Chain up completed, they knelt down. The dew, more likely than not, was mist by then. Heavy sometimes, and if the dogs were quiet and just breathing, you could hear doves. Kneeling in the midst, they waited for the whim of a guard, or two, or three, or maybe all of them wanted it. Wanted it from one prisoner in particular, or none, or all. Breakfast? Want some breakfast, nigger? Yes, sir. Hungry, nigger? Yes, sir. Here you go. Occasionally, a kneeling man chose gunshot in his head as the price, maybe, of taking a bit of foreskin with him to Jesus. Paul D. did not know that then. He was looking at his palsied hands, smelling the guard, listening to his soft grunts so like the doves, as he stood before the man kneeling in mist on his right. Convinced he was left, he was next, Paul D. retched, vomiting up nothing at all. An observing guard smashed his shoulder with the rifle, and the engaged one decided to skip the new man for the time being, lest his pants and shoes got soiled by nigger puke. That's Paul D.'s experience of slavery. He and the other men aren't able to escape by fluke. It rains, and it rains, and it rains. And the clay soil around their cages collapses. And to a man, they're able to dive through the clay soil that's become liquefied and up and out and able to sneak out of the camp. They meet up with some Cherokee Indians who help them take off the chains and they escape north. And for the rest of the years between the 1850s and 1872, when he shows up in Cincinnati, he wanders, not able to stay in one place for very long. But despite his experiences, and despite the fact that he, like Setha, spends a lot of his energy trying not to remember what his life was like in slavery, he's able to see in Setha something that he needs and that she also needs. At the end of the book, when Setha's been through this all-encompassing relationship with Beloved and hasn't even left the house for months on end. And after Beloved has left, Paul D. shows up again. And she's crying and she says that she misses Beloved, that she was my best thing. This is what Paul D. thinks. Paul D. sits down in the rocking chair and examines the quilt patched in carnival colors. His hands are limp between his knees. There are too many things to feel about this woman. His head hurts. Suddenly he remembers another of the Sweet Home men trying to describe what he felt about his woman. She is a friend of my mind, She gather me in, man, the pieces I am. She gather them and give them back to me in all the right order. It's good, you know, when you got a woman who is a friend of your mind. Paul is staring at the, thinking about her wrought iron back, the delicious mouth still puffy at the corner from Ella's fist, the mean black eyes, the wet dress steaming before the fire. Only this woman, Sepha, could have left him his manhood like that. He wants to put his story next to hers. Sepha, he says, me and you, we got more yesterday than anybody. We need some kind of tomorrow. He leans over and takes her hand. With the other, he touches her face. You, your best thing, Sepha. You are. His holding fingers are holding hers. Me, she says. Me? So Paul's response is, despite everything, to want a tomorrow. And to believe that it's possible through this relationship with Sepha. There's a way in which I'm sorry that I've told you so much of the story, because part of the magnetism of this book is being lured into, she gives hints and suggestions, and then the story unfolds like this. But it's also true that it's a very hard book to read, as that scene in Alfred, Georgia suggests. There's a lot to come face to face with that as white people, it may be very difficult to stomach. So maybe knowing that there's a redemptive end of some kind may help you get through. So those are the three responses that Toni Morrison suggests. One is death over slavery as a preference. The other is an attempt to love and defeat. And Paul D's determination, although we don't know if it comes to be, that there is something worth living for, and that you have to make a tomorrow despite all of the yesterdays that you carry with you. So that's Toni Morrison's story. And I wondered if you had questions about the book or wanted to think some more about some of the responses that she proposes, particularly a very difficult one around Sepha's choice to kill her child rather than see it in slavery. For her, it wasn't a choice. She just did it. She just knew that after what had happened to her, which I didn't even describe to you. I mean, she had...
It was awful.
It was awful, right?
Just awful.
You've read the book.
Yes. Just awful.
When I heard you talk about this, you were saying about how it impacted their relationships. Could you talk more about that?
Well, for example, Sepha lacking mothering. One interesting study that I read on the book talked about objects relations theory and the necessity for the parent, particularly the mother, to mirror back to the child, and that's a process through which the child becomes aware of its own integrity and identity. Am I getting that approximately right? And that simply looking at the story in terms of object relations theory, you have a social system, slavery, that structured the mothering out of existence. Sepha's own mother disappeared after 2 or 3 weeks. She hardly saw her, wasn't nursed by her. Baby Suggs Holy had 8 children by 6 different men. She wasn't being promiscuous, it was just that she was sold from one owner to one owner to one owner, the next. And I think those were only the black men. That probably wasn't counting when she might have been bred by her white owners. And she experienced constantly giving birth to children, raising them so far, and then seeing them sold off. So she describes Paul D. is observing Setha and Setha's relationship with her daughter, which turns out to be very possessive. I mean, Setha doesn't have any boundaries. She, you know, she assumes that she has the right to take the life of her children. She has this very enmeshed relationship with Denver. Denver can't even get out the front yard of her house. She's never gone farther than the front yard for most of her 16 or 17 years. And when Beloved shows up, they all just collapse together like a black hole. But Paul D. is watching Setha, and he's thinking it's very risky for a used-to-be slave woman to love anything that much was dangerous, especially if it was her children she had settled on to love. The best thing, he knew, was to love just a little bit, everything, just a little bit. So when they broke its back or shoved it in a Kroger sack, well, maybe you'd have a little love left over for the next one. So baby Suggs gave birth to 8 children. Holly was the only one that she knew, and that she and Holly were sold together to Sweet Home, and that Holly was allowed to purchase her freedom. But she, at one point, she's remembering how little she remembers about the children. One, she remembers like the burnt crust of bottom of the bread, and that's all she can remember about this child. You know, another sort of distinguishing feature of each one. She doesn't know where they are, where they've gone, what's become them. So she's learned, so for her to claim her heart and let it beat, and to tell each other, love others themselves, because as she says, you can only love yourself. No one else is going to do this for you.
So part of what is implied in all the brokenness is, in some ways, not a sense of when this might resolve itself or what that would look like, you know, that
right.
There's some really kind of open-ended.
Well, that's why Paul D. is so important, because somehow, somehow he can think that there's got to be some kind of tomorrow, even though he's never stayed in any place longer than 6 months and never bedded down with anyone longer than that. But he remembers that about the woman who was a friend of a woman who is a friend of your mind. Somehow that appeals to him. How he's able to come to that, the story, you're not really sure, but he's, from the very beginning, he has a certain strength that many of the other characters lack.
Yeah, this, when I was young and really into social change on a very radical level, I used to just idealize people who had suffered like this and thought they would just be saints. Huh. And one of the great things about, first of all, getting to know real people on a day-to-day basis, as I did when I worked in Philadelphia, and secondly, reading things like this is a much much more realistic sense of who people really are, and a deeper appreciation of the real humanity and the real ways they're able to transcend these terrible conditions instead of some idealized one.
And transcend them sometimes in very crippled ways. Mm-hmm. Killing one's children, even though in the Margaret Garner case, the abolitionists and in particular the suffragist Lucy Stone came to town and spoke on Margaret Garner's behalf, and she herself claimed that she could understand why you would want to send your child back to Jesus where it would suffer no more. That's still a pretty hard choice to make.
She had really just unremitting blackness in terms of what life would be as a slave for this child.
Right.
And it was almost an act of hope in some ways.
An act of hope.
That this child could escape, I thought.
This was a kind of
she
escape.
She could bear it. But she wasn't sure that her child.
Uh-huh. It was a kind of escape. That's true.
And the hope would be that this kind of escape wouldn't have possibilities.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, that it wouldn't. I mean, we hear it as ending possibilities, but what you're saying is that, you know, returning to God or whatever mm-hmm. is holding up possibilities.
Uh-huh. Well, that was the only hope that was possible mm-hmm. to have, as I remember.
Yeah.
Could you speak a little? I have never read a book that had the thoughts. You know, you're reading along, and then all of a sudden it's as if you're thinking and you're talking to someone, and that reminds you of something else. And so she writes about this something else, and uh-huh. you're disoriented.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Where in the world
is this coming from?
Yes. I have never, you know, I've read books where you go back, but you know you're going back.
Uh-huh.
You know, they say this is 17 something or the other, but she doesn't.
Yeah, suddenly you're moved into this.
Into another orientation, to uh-huh. another space, uh-huh. story.
Why do you think that might be particular to this story, and that there's a reason?
Well, it's disorienting.
It's disorienting, yeah.
It took me a long time to.
I'm wondering if that stylistic decision isn't partly based on the disorientation of someone who's been traumatized and the kind of shifts in consciousness. Jack, can you speak to that?
Well, that's the way I experienced it. And that's what I both found, like I said, disorienting, but almost exciting, you know, to be with somebody. I mean, it really felt like I had the trust to go walk with her in this way of mm-hmm. looking at her world and talking about things. So in some ways that was exciting. Where other authors kind of bring you along, you know, in their craft of telling the story. But this was an experience on another level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was wondering how much of it was a cultural thing too. I mean, it could be, I hear you saying it could be related to a person who's experienced trauma, but I also wonder, you know, how things come together if that isn't also part of the message in some ways. Because, see, to me, in my training as a therapist, you listen to the stories that people string together. And so there's often themes in the string of stories that we tell. And that's kind of what she does. She strings some things together in, mm-hmm. in a way that's foreign mm-hmm. to us, but I wonder what the message is in the way that she's stringing these associations through. I mean, that would be the other part of it.
You suggest that the kind of connections that we know in terms of relationship and understanding the world are very tenuous for these people.
Well, that, the reason I felt that she killed the child out of hope, Beloved was that child.
Is that how you understood
her? I read
her?
It.
Uh-huh.
And Beloved was very real for her and lived, but I mean, is that how you saw Beloved?
I did on the first couple of go-rounds through the novel.
I only read it once.
It gets easier the second time around. You can distance yourself from some of the horror and see what she's doing. But when I read an article that talked about wild children, and there have been some instances in this century, or late 20th century, of children who were kept in rooms,
yeah.
Not stimulated. Some of their characteristics are very similar to what Beloved has. Odd things like a craving for liquids and soft foods, can't eat hard foods. Talks in a way as if she's sort of creating the words as she goes because she's never had conversations. So to ease my mind, I couldn't quite it didn't quite work for me to see her as the reincarnation. But to see her as this wild child, but in a way it doesn't really matter. That just satisfies my logical mind. Mm-hmm. She functions as the reincarnation, and that's what's important to love it, to Setha and her daughter. And as they fall into this black hole of this relationship where literally Beloved eats all the food and grows bigger and bigger and bigger, and Setha shrinks and her clothes hang on her and she loses weight. And Beloved's consuming her. This is a psychological consumption that manifests physically. I wanted to say something else about how the narrative flows. One thing that Morrison's able to do rather well that I don't see often in other authors is assume a point of view from the different characters. Now, there are omniscient narrators who can peer into people's minds and tell you what's going on, but suddenly you have a switched frame of reference. It's like turning the lens on a camera, and the focus shifts somewhat so that we get to know Paul D because we see through Setha through Paul D's eyes, and we get to know that the story about Setha killing her children comes through the slave owner, ironically enough. We get to hear from Denver, Setha's daughter. We get to hear from Beloved. So all of these different voices are very strong in the text. Usually you have an omniscient narrator, you get a sense of the voice of the narrator representing the voices of these other people. But it's much more like standing in an echo chamber getting all of these voices. So,
maybe that is somewhat of the cultural difference too. In a way, because I think for the Euro-Americans, we tend to be very individualistic in our kind of worldview. But the African-Americans that I've worked with continue to hold up the relationship with community in ways that I've had one woman say she doesn't feel shame individually, she feels that for the whole family. She's more worried about shaming the family than, you know, herself. And maybe it is that ability to have empathy and to realize how it impacts other people and to move in that, you know, throughout the community and about that kind of free associating through the community that she seems to be able to do and to get different perspectives in ways that are different than...
I'm glad you brought that up, because the issue of the household at 124, their relationship to the community is also ruptured. So there are two things. One has to do with Morrison's narrative strategy and the way she's able to bring this community of voices in. I think that's a very interesting perspective. But secondly, the way she depicts the fractured relationship between Setha and her family and the community. What happens after Setha kills her children, it's not, the evil starts before then. It's not that she's killed her children, it's that she doesn't ask for help after she's been in prison that the community can't stand. Mm-hmm. And even before the bounty hunters showed up, what immediately preceded that was a great feast, a love feast that Baby Suggs put on very spontaneously, and it was just too much. She broke her own law of love. It was just too much, and the community becomes alienated from her. And that's why the bounty hunters ended up at the property, because in the black community, they were always on the watch for strangers, and they knew what was going on. People saw them, but no one told the family at 124. So they showed up and took them by surprise. So there was already this rupture, and it had to do with sort of perhaps arrogance, perhaps distinguishing oneself in the community, not taking one's proper place, and then Setha's inability to stay in relationship with the community and increasingly become isolated over time. So yes, community and the rupture with community is very important. Because around the family, you see the way in which the African-American community take care of one another. There's a character in particular that runs through the novel. His name is Stamp Paid, because he figures he's paid his dues, and he's the one who ferried Seth across the river, and he's sort of the messenger. He's like a Hermes character.
He's kind of a figure across the river Styx, you know, you're
right,
ferrying them to the other shore.
Right, only presumably this time from death to life, the irony being that Seth decrees death in that. But he continues through the novel to try to interact and try to bring the community back in relationship with Seth and the family. So community is very, very important. And ultimately it's the community that arouses itself to exorcise this ghost.
So that would be almost another theme then, in terms of what's the community role in this.
Right.
As they respond to the quote evil of slavery.
Right. Right.
I think every white person should read that.
Amen, amen. Huh? Amen.
Because?
Well, because I know I certainly never thought of slavery in those terms. I thought of slavery as a, you know, that you got up and you worked, you just didn't collect any money, but everybody treated you nice. And I think it's, I mean, I was really in denial over what it must have been like. And that was one hard book to read. I admire you for reading it again.
That's very interesting. So that part of the kind of practical implications of it, in terms of when you're somebody else's property, what kind of things get acted out, is something that was less.
And what people, I mean, they didn't treat them as people. It was just
right, treated as animals.
It's awful.
Worse than animals, because they would have taken care of their animals. So, I wonder where this book led you. So you've learned something new about slavery and the heritage of slavery for African Americans.
Well, we read it for a book club, you know, and as we talk here, I don't remember ever talking about the book. I think we came together and we just couldn't bear to talk about it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I may reread it, maybe. But I thought it was just a marvelous book that everybody should read.
Well, this time, talk about it.
You may even want to ask her what happened.
I mean, yeah.
Why was it that we kind of skipped over this? I mean, that was very interesting. Because part of the purpose of the book club is to push each other to read. I mean, that's what I, when I join a book club, that's part of it, is to...
Well, to talk about it.
Yeah.
But I think the book was maybe just too much.
Sure.
Well, and that for me, because Toni Morrison's talking about 1872, but she's talking about it because these issues are still very real for the African-American community, and that's what she wants us, that's part of what she wants us to know. This is the heritage that we still have to account for somehow. Elias, what were you, Jonathan, were you going to say something?
I was going to say essentially that. That there are lots of other people going through, you know, different kinds of extreme experiences of evil in extreme circumstances. In various situations. My own mother was a refugee, for example. Although they were not treated nearly as badly. They went through some really bad stuff that she only the last few years has been willing to describe verbally. But I wouldn't put it in on the same plane at all. It's just it just kind of reflecting the same direction.
Well, I think it's, were they...
They were European Jews.
Yeah,
picked up by
involved
Hitler.
In the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Well, like Elie Wiesel didn't talk about it for years and years and years. I mean, you find a lot of people who just aren't able to face it.
And
to look at evil, right? You know, in that book, right in your face.
Yeah.
But I'm very glad to have those three responses to consider thinking about these other instances of evil in our own century. There's the Cambodians too. Much, much clearer example.
I love it.
Then kind of observing and now understanding better people's differing responses. You know, I'm grateful to have this knowledge.
Uh-huh. Let me say one last thing, and that has to do with my own response to these responses, and that I think this is, although I've been consciously reading works by African Americans mm-hmm. over the last several years, and this book in particular, I won't say it's the final push, but it's one that certainly has weighed very heavily. Like you, it was a picture of slavery that that I hadn't been willing to acknowledge in quite that extreme.
I just didn't imagine.
In the gut, yeah. gut response that one gets to the pictures of slavery here. And that, so that for me, this is my next project, is to think about my responsibility for racism. And I'm doing that in two levels. One is that I will be working with the National Conference of Christian and Jews, who in our area do excellent human relations training, which in Southern California is not just with African Americans, but also with Latinos and Asians. And then secondly, to look at my own family history. On my father's side, we had Quaker slave owners in North Carolina who in the late 1700s, early 1800s, probably did not set their slaves free, but I don't know for sure, left North Carolina and then moved north. Of course, they moved into stolen Indian lands. So, but you know, I have that personal relationship. A lot of Americans can walk around saying, well, I don't really have any responsibility for this. I wasn't a slave owner. Well, I have a little more personal responsibility. So I'm taking that seriously and using that autobiographical piece as a starting point for me to reflect on my responsibility for racism, and then to look at the ways in which my family heritage may also give me something in a way that I can respond positively. So learning more and trying to increase my contact with African Americans in an honest way and to own up to my racism, that's my response to this evil. So I offer that. Any final thoughts?
Say the three responses again. Murder to
Well, I think Cephas was death. An option. Mm-hmm. Baby Suggs was an attempt to love that was ultimately defeated. An attempt to affirm individual dignity that she felt ultimately was thwarted. And Paul D, however, finding strength to affirm that you can have tomorrow despite your yesterdays. And that that's also found in relationship. Well, thank you all for coming and sharing this book with me.
Yeah, well, it's thank you. Really some book.
So it suggests a bunch of other things that I want to think about.
Yeah.
Such as, I'm really interested in your response to, you know, you're talking about family history. Coming from my own place, a response like that would almost let me off the hook, since my ancestors did come almost immediately from Europe. But I've taken on the culture that uh-huh. oppressed these folks and continues to do so in some ways. And to that extent, you know, I'm going to have to do some work too.
Yeah, and you accept that. I think one of the critical issues for most privileged people in this country is that we don't accept complicity in a larger system. And somehow, I want to find a way for talking about a responsibility that's maybe commensurate with our place in mm-hmm. this larger transcending social evil. Yeah. That's tough
there,
to do.
There is literature on it.
Well, around. One of the things I've been wrestling with is we had a certain way of talking about prejudice in the 60s, mm-hmm. and I don't think we found a different way of talking about it in the 90s. So somehow I think it still is active and takes different shapes, but I don't know that we found new ways of engaging it. And so, I mean, I've had people in my training, I train clergy, and when I have a mixed group, one of the things that will happen when the issues start to arise that I think are related to cultural differences, people will kind of reassure me, well, I've got an African American friend and we don't have any problems. you know, and so somehow we've been able to kind of set up some criteria by which we then kind of step back from some of the interpersonal stuff. And then there's still the overriding, I want to say, theology that people want so bad to see the commonality that they don't see the differences. And then I